listening to Law and Justice on UCC 98.3 FM. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and we have a very, very varied show for you today. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Aman Desande from the School of Religion in UCC. He is the lecturer on contemporary Islam, and he's going to be talking to us all about issues in that area. We also have a segment on the Commission for the Future of Policing in Ireland, and also an interview with Dr. Doug Cuby from the School of Law here on disaster law. So we will actually begin with the segment on the future of policing. I spoke with Dr. Vicky Conway and Ms. Kathleen O'Toole, who is the chair of the commission.
Here at the Woodkey venue with Dr. Vicky Conway, who is an expert in policing in Ireland and on the Commission for the Future of Policing. Vicky, can you tell me a little bit about this consultation process and how you found it so far?
So we're engaged. So the Commission on the Future of Policing has been tasked effectively with drafting a blueprint for the future of policing in Ireland, much like the Patent Commission in Northern Ireland. And a key part of that is to hear as broadly as possible from everyone concerned about this. So we've been meeting directly with stakeholders. We've been visiting a great many Garda stations. I think we've been to 17 or 18 so far, and having in-depth meetings with management and Garda rank at those stations. And we've also been travelling around the country, running a range of public events in different formats, sometimes kind of open public consultations, sometimes more one-on-one conversations with people. And this is really because, and I actually quite firmly believe that everyone in society almost has a duty to contribute to this, that how we want to be policed in the future, what we want to get from our police, but also, you know, the police are dependent on the public. They need people to come forward to engage with what they're doing. They need victims, they need witnesses, all of that. So, you know, for policing to work, everyone has to buy into it. So it's really important that we hear from a really broad perspective of people. And so far, that has been happening. So we've been getting a range of people who are talking a lot about how they really value their community police, and that at the local level, they've seen some really great stuff. But a lot of concerns as well. Sometimes that's about resources. They're not seeing enough guards. Guard visibility comes up a lot. But, you know, there are people coming to us who have very particular issues.
Would that be a bigger issue in the rural communities?
The visibility?
Yeah.
No, not so much. I mean, it came up a lot in Cork. I mean, we'll see tonight. So this is, you know, the open event in Dublin this evening, and we're really interested. There's a very long list of stakeholders have signed up, so we're really interested to hear what people have to say this evening.
And I was speaking briefly to Dr. Johnny Connolly, who's a member of the commission as well. He said the Limerick group was quite interesting because you had a community gathering of people from Moyross and other areas, and they were saying how they valued community policing. Has that come up in other areas
I think that's a massive theme, that and I imagine we'll hear a bit more of that tonight, that people want guards that are embedded in their communities, that know their communities, that contribute to them in a broad range of ways, which of course, you know, if you have a guard who's coaching the local camogie team, and we hear a lot of that, there are still a lot of guards doing that kind of thing, they get to know those kids and they have a better respect for the police, but they also get to know the families, you know, and all of that. So these are really positive things that can really shape policing in a really great way. And if, you know, some of the groups that are coming along, I think, you know, there's a lot of people here that are very passionate about what has happened to date in policing, which has not always been right. You know, we know that. But also how they want it to be in the future. And this is the thing, like, the commission is not about what happened in the past. We need to understand
that, obviously,
but we are absolutely about what do we want the future to be? What do we want the guards to prioritise? You know, how do we want them resourced? How do we want them structured? How do we want them led? How do we want them overseen? What technology do we want them to have?
So is it a difficult task in terms of blending a kind of idealism with then also a realism about what is actually achievable?
Yeah, it is a very challenging task, and the scale of it is huge. But I think we're really lucky in the depth of the expertise on the commission. So we have a number of academics. We have two people that have served as police overseas and have managed police services overseas. We have management consultants. We have representatives of victims' organisations. We have a woman that ran the police college in Canada, you know, really diverse range of expertise, and that really helps make sure we get all the pieces together.
I'm here with Ms. Kathleen O'Toole, who's the chair of the Commission for the Future of Policing. Kathleen, how did you find the consultation this evening in Dublin at Wood Quay?
Well, similar to other places we've been, it was incredibly informative. I always really appreciate the people that come forward and have the courage to tell very personal stories.
Yes.
And I think everyone tonight contributed in a very constructive way. It's so important that we get out and listen to people who are living and working in the neighborhoods throughout the country. And tonight, again, once again, was it's wonderful to see people come out. They're eager to engage. They want to see a bright future for policing in Ireland. They're willing to contribute to the process. So I think it's very heartening, and I really appreciate that people made the effort to come tonight.
And are there certain themes that have been raised time and again at these sessions? Community policing, I believe, has come up a lot.
Yeah, we heard a lot about community policing tonight. You know, people want to see guards in their neighborhoods. You know, frontline policing is really a concern. They want to see people in their neighborhoods. They want to engage with them constructively. I think we've also been hearing a lot about the need for multidisciplinary issues, that intersection, particularly at that intersection between public safety and public health, whether it's addiction or mental health issues or homelessness, really coming up with a policing strategy that works with other facets or other government departments, but the NGOs and the other community groups in order to address these complicated issues. So, it really validated a lot of the conclusions we're coming to early on, but also new issues were raised. We always hear something new.
And, which is great. That's what you want, I guess.
That's precisely what. We need to validate some of our early thinking, but even more important, we need to hear new ideas. And I think we had some fantastic contributions tonight.
And Dr. Mary Rogan struck an optimistic note at the very outset, saying this is about the future, as you did yourself. This is not about the past or the present. We're looking at what can Irish policing be going forward. Are you hopeful that we can build an exceptional human rights based policing service in Ireland?
I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe that. I mean that sincerely. Mm-hmm. I've worked a lot on police reform in the past. I've seen organizations turn around. And again, we're building in many respects. I mean, there are good things in the organization. I really appreciated that Professor Rogan, asked people to cite positive examples as well.
That's good.
Because there are times where we'll build on positives. So there are other times where we'll recommend practices be discarded and new ideas emerge. So, but I thought it was a very constructive and productive discussion tonight.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and I'm joined now in studio by Dr. Aman Dasandi from the School of Religion at UCC. I heard Aman speak at the SESCA event on human rights before Christmas and was extremely impressed, and he made me think a lot about religion and its objects and purposes and how things can get warped over time in their interpretation. So thanks for joining me, Aman.
Thanks for having me.
Aman, can you tell us what prompted you to devote your academic life to the study of contemporary Islam?
So I grew up in quite a traditional Muslim family where it's part of my blood.
Okay.
It's just we would always religion for me wasn't something distinct. Religion for me was mixed in my parents' heritage. So to be Pakistani in a sense is also to be religiously at some level Muslim and Islamic. In the same way that you could say that those threads are intertwined in what it means to be Irish or Catholic and all of these identity mm-hmm. factors. And so that was really what I grew up at home. And outside, it was very much a white Presbyterian culture, which was for me, battling against these two. And here I am. I'm a mixture of these. I'm a dazzling mixture of these. In a sense that I feel that I'm 50% Pakistani and 50% Scottish, and there's nothing that kind of comes in between that.
Fair enough. And so your research profile at the School of Religion here in UCC states that you connect the study of Islam to the key themes of gender, ethnicity, race and pluralism. That's pretty impressive. What does it mean? How do you do this?
Well, this is, you know, when I was trying to identify what I understand by contemporary Islam, these are really the key critical issues that I think Muslims internally are dealing with, are discussing and are trying to make sense of. And actually, you know, so that's the specific. But generally, I think these are also issues that other religions, Christianities and, you know, Judaisms and everything else in between and beyond is also having to deal with. These are issues that really matter in the world today, and, and how we deal with them is we're really at a crossroads, and there's no way of actually picking them out. And religion is interwoven in all of these discussions and debates. And so that, I think, is why for me it is the key themes.
Is that because they're so inextricably linked with their own personal identities?
Oh, absolutely. Religion, you know, this idea that people have that religion is something distinct and divine and sacred, we really need to unread this, because there's a real human element within all of these. Of course, the idea of an ambiguous construction or idea of a god is something divine or sacred, whatever way you want to look at it. But what we understand in terms of sacred knowledge comes from a very human endeavor, right? Texts are texts, right? Whether they be divine or not, they require the human intellect. They require the human capacity to think through them critically. Mm. And even, I mean, let me give you one example. Even if you think that, you know, a text has come from beyond this world, from God, well, it's not in the hands of God anymore. It's in the hands of human beings, which means that human beings have to articulate and understand and interpret them. And exactly the same, you can find parallels within law. Mm-hmm. Right? Law can be interpreted. Nothing is black and white.
Yes.
Right? You may tell somebody to stop at a stoplight and why it's important to do that, but people try to find loopholes. Right? And in exactly the same way, we need to have the same mentality when it comes to sacred law. Mm. Islamic law is no different to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that for me, it's actually just making it more real. And I think that is what has sustained these ancient traditions and religions for so long, because they have that ambiguity. They have that doubt. They have that question, right? Faith is all about questioning and doubt. The idea of God is so ambiguous. That's what makes it exciting. And that's why we are still talking about these things. Religion isn't going anywhere. The idea of God isn't going anywhere. We are the ones who have the problem in trying to interpret and accept pluralism and differences and different ways of looking at it.
And why do we have such problems with these things? Why is pluralism a challenge for us?
I think we've at a certain level, some individuals, and dare I say it, men, have tried to put across a very clear definition of what things are. And, you know, that's mixed with power, politics, authority, and people sit there and say, oh, this is it. This is the way that it should be understood. And that has caused a lot of issues and a lot of suffering. And a lot of suffering, not just suffering, abuse, and killing, and terror and war and bloodshed. All of this stems from the way in which we've interpreted something that's ambiguous.
Right.
And that is something that we really need to think about. And that's something that keeps, I think, a lot of religion scholars awake up at night, is trying to understand these interpretations.
Right. And so the Quran or the Bible or any of these sacred books, are they really about trying to guide us into living better, more humane lives?
I think so. I hope so. that there's something that these texts are trying to push us towards thinking about what is right, what is wrong, what is moral, what is not. But it requires a lot of thinking, and it requires a thinking mind. There's no such, you know, all of these texts are very, very thoughtful texts, and how we interpret and think about them is very, very important. And I said this at the event, and I always say this: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam do not walk in the street.
It is
the human being that walks in the street. So no two Christians are alike, no two Jews are alike, and no two Muslims are alike. And once we begin to appreciate that, we really begin to understand the depths of pluralism. And in a way, it quashes out the anybody who tries to promote this center point or this is the Islamic, this is the Christian view, this is the Jewish view. Well, that's not a tenable statement anymore. There are many, many, many different interpretations and living embodiments of that faith. And that's very, very exciting. But it scares the living daylights out of people who want to control people, who want to abuse people, who want to kill people.
Yeah. So basically, we should also, I suppose, if we're religious people going to mass or the synagogue or wherever else, we need to not want to have definitive answers from the person up there.
Well, the thing is that I think at some level, the person who's standing at the pulpit has to give a definitive answer. Okay. But our biggest challenge is pluralism. Is how do we live in a world of differences of opinion and different ways of living your life? That, I think, is very challenging. Mm-hmm. From the left to the right. Mm. You know, a real lefty bleeding heart liberal has to accept, you know, the capacity or the position of somebody that you completely oppose. That's a very big challenge. Mm. So I believe that, you know, in freedom of speech and being able to spout out and say whatever the craziness you want to, but I have hope. Mm-hmm. And this, for me, if I take off my academic hat, comes from a very faithful position, where I think that, you know, let people say all these crazy things. Let's have hope and let's have faith at some level that good will overcome evil. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have that, then I don't know what we've got. Right. And we must strive constantly and consistently to offer counter narratives, mm-hmm. offer a different. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, even in the courtroom, you have the defense and the prosecution. And so, you know, one person's doing this and the other person, and, you know, even though one may think, you know, even if there is a lawyer that thinks this person is completely guilty, but I'm going to stand back, this is it. Mm-hmm. And this is something I think that's very, very challenging, and trying to make sense of that and hopefully trying to uphold some goodness. And we need to build more bridges than burn them.
Sure.
And that's something very important, I think.
And you wrote a book entitled The Crisis of Islamic Masculinities, which is a very thought-provoking title. What were some of your findings there in a little nutshell?
Well, the main question that I was asking in that book is there something that we could say is an ideal Muslim man? Right. And I read a lot of books before I did my PhD at Glasgow University. And I did a lot of reading on Jewish and Christian masculinities. And when I was reading them, I thought, this is really interesting. I don't think there is a center point. And people kept saying to me, oh, yes, there is an ideal Islamic masculinity. And I said, well, where is that coming from? And I was just like, because the Quran is really very colorful. It has all these different men. It has dysfunctional families. It doesn't actually, in some sense, it supports the heterosexual unit, but at some levels, it also doesn't. You have men who are married. You may have men who are not married. You have prophets who don't have a father, Jesus, for example. Mm-hmm. You have Muhammad who has 12, 13 wives. What does that say about Islamic masculinity? So my conclusion was that there's no ideal.
Okay.
There's no ideal. In exactly the same way that if you ask, hopefully, a thoughtful, reflective Jew or a Christian, they will give you the exact same answer. Who doesn't want to control your thoughts? And so what you have is, and that's very, very, very challenging. Mm. You know, I thought, oh, okay, this is my conclusion. But the ripple effects or people's response to that has been huge, because in a sense, we have to also remember that gender plays a huge role in the construction of religion. If religion isn't a thing, we have made it into a thing, and that thing is often associated with masculinity, which is heterosexuality. And so we must unpack and unread and be critical in that. And that's something that I always tell my students, and they always have a giggle about this. I said, this is what turns me on about religion, is that you can ask these critical questions and nothing really is sacred, because it's all open. It's up for grabs. And that, for me, I think has kind of set the whole gender and sexuality debate within Islam. But exactly the same debates are happening within other religious traditions as well.
And so as a Muslim man with Pakistani parents, you remarked previously that when you came to Cork and UCC, you felt kind of visible because Cork is a bit of a white city. Have you ever had any kind of unpleasant experiences, either because of your religion or your skin colour? Because we're living in an era of great fear and sometimes intolerance. Hopefully you haven't, but Have you been uncomfortable at times here?
Well, you know, it's important to note that people of colour have, are become accustomed to microaggressions every day. And that we, you know, I bring this up sometimes and I say, you know, I can't jump out of my skin. When you're white skinned, you can walk about being quite neutral. I can't. So when I walk around, I can't shout all the time. I'm from Glasgow, I'm from Scotland. People think, oh, okay, are you a refugee? Are you this? Are you that? You know, to the extent that once on a taxi, the taxi driver said to me, was it difficult for you to get a visa to come to this country? And I said, well, you know, the checks weren't that bad when I flew in from Scotland. And he must have thought I came in on a boat or something. But, you know, and so this is the kind of discussions and debates that I think are important, that are important to people. But I think a lot of the time it's ignorance. I'm an optimist to the extent that I think people don't have that kind of malice or, you know, that hatred or racism. But yeah, I've never really experienced anything too bad. In one occasion, I was in Cork city centre where there was a man who started shouting, you're taking all our jobs and go back to where you came from. And I really wanted to say I'm actually from Glasgow, but I just kind of ignored it because I thought he was just, you know, just drunk.
And does not have very enlightened thoughts or a pluralist view of the world.
No. But you know, it's this is something that we're here in Ireland is developing.
Well,
right?
Yes.
So it's developing to the extent that, you know, people are beginning to ask questions, and people, I think, are very open to seeing those differences. In Scotland, I had a very different experience. You know,
it's more multicultural for a long time.
I was going to use the word normalised, but that's probably not the right word. But you know, we brown people are very much a part of the society. I always say I'm unapologetically brown. I'm unapologetically Muslim. Sometimes I probably have to say I'm unapologetically Scottish in some contexts as well. But it kind of just makes you it's the everyday living. But on a positive note, I think UCC here we look at us locally. We have a lot to be proud of. There's a lot happening. The new development of a unit which is looking at equality, diversity, wonderful, you know. And Dr. Carl Kitching is the director of that. Lots of very excellent, you know, thoughts coming out. The new president that came in is talking about diversity and all these issues. I feel very much loved at UCC.
Oh, good.
I do. And you know, that makes me very happy. I have a very, very good response from students. What I would like to see is the diversification of faculty and staff.
Yes.
But it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
You can't put out job ads and say, oh, we're looking for more brown and black people. Say that, you know, but
I know what you mean.
Yes, yeah. And sometimes when you can't say that, some people use that in a way mixed in bureaucracy, which then kind of leads to questions about institutionalized racism. You know, all of this is very, very complicated.
But
you have to hold hope.
Yes.
And you know, that there are people who are at the helm of all of this who have a vision of plurality and of diversity. And I think they do.
I think they do too.
Yeah.
Two final questions. You mentioned about Ireland and Catholicism kind of being very fused. The grip that the church had in Ireland has slipped a lot in the light of recent scandals pretty much since the 90s. And many younger people have little or nothing to do with religion anymore, or religious life. Do you believe that the abandonment of faith on a kind of mass level may have negative repercussions down the road?
That's very complicated, you know, because what does it mean to abandon your faith? Like I said to you, you know, I meet a lot of Muslims who are like, oh, I don't believe in it anymore. But, you know, it's funny. It's kind of part of your blood.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
You grew up in it.
Yeah.
And you kind of...
It surrounds you.
It's part of your culture. I just think, I don't know, I think that there... It's about trying to understand these nuances. It's trying to understand, you know, what role does faith have?
Mm.
And sometimes people abandon faith for all sorts of different reasons.
Mm.
But part of it is, can my faith, can my religious tradition be as colourful as I am?
Right.
And that, I think, is a very important question for a lot of the youth, mm-hmm. right, who I have no idea what's happening with my with the students who sit in my class because they're so, they're in a completely different way. But, you know, what I find really hopeful is they get diversity and they get all these differences in ways that I sometimes sit around and I think, we lecturers are not getting it. Mm-hmm. And these, our students are way, way ahead of it. The way in which we box, the boxes are not good. I think the problem we have is boxes. Secular, religious, these are not,
they're not helpful.
They're not helpful and actually they're nonsensical. Someone can be very secular on one issue and very religious on another. Someone can be very liberal on one issue and very conservative on the other. The problem is we love boxes and we love putting people in boxes. We need to stop doing that and we need to be more we need to celebrate mess more. We need to celebrate dysfunction more. And that scares a lot of people, but I think that's a very, very good thing because that's the reality. And being in the grey areas rather than just the black and white gives us an idea of this complicated mess. I mean, yesterday's announcement on the discussions on the repeal of the, mm-hmm. the abortion laws. Mm-hmm. I'm watching this thinking, this is going to be very interesting discussion. Yes. From the religious to the not the religious, from the medical to the all of it. And that's the beauty of democracy. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of debate and arriving at your own moral morality and all of these and ethics is very, very important. One thing that I do say is let's not base our morality and our ethics on party politics. I really don't trust politicians. Mm-hmm. Well, what I worry about is when we get led to believe that what the politician is saying is moral. Yes. The politicians are on a different set. They're doing something very different. Hats off to them. And, you know, I admire a lot of them. But we must remember to have a more sober, idea. In the same way that you think, oh, a lawyer is going to be very fair. A lawyer is going to be very, moral. Mm. Absolute nonsense. Mm. We know a lot of bent lawyers and a lot of bent judges and all that. I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this. But gives you an idea of, you know, what we need is the more critical capacity to think through these things mm-hmm. and to think carefully about what kind of a society we want to create. How do we want to deal with our neighbour? And that, I think, once we get to that, we'll begin to see something prosperous. UCC is the best place to do that because we are really holding the bastion of independent creative thinking. So this is the place.
How do we, though, celebrate dysfunction and mess more to serve pluralism? That's my final question.
How do we? Yeah, this is at the grassroots level. I don't really have an answer to that, and so people need to be able to answer that. Who are actually the real activists? I'm just trying to theorize this. But I think one way is to allow diversity of voices to appear, allow that diversity to actually give it the stage, give it the platform.
Whether it's hateful or loving or kind.
I do. I think where we stop is do not encroach on my liberty to say what I want to do and do not harm me, mm-hmm. right? And so you allow somebody to say what they want to say in hope that we have created a society of thought, of critical inquiry, where someone or a body is going to stand up and say, well, I've got a count, this is wrong.
Okay.
Yeah? And I think that's where you begin to see it in hope that through this, you know, this point and counterpoint, you begin to arrive at something that's right. So it's kind of like trying to allow that tussle, to kind of exist. But you also have to remember that part of that dysfunction is that many of us and many people on the streets are living very dysfunctional, messy lives, right?
I know it.
Where we start to think, we read these novels, where people tell me, oh yes, when I was doing my PhD, people were like, yes, the ideal Islamic is marriage, 2.4 children and all the rest of it. Mm. And I'm just like, well, even our texts don't say that. But people don't know how to deal with that. People mm-hmm. don't know how to. But it's appreciating. It's being aware of that diversity. And we forget the social structures, even at the human level. This is why it's important to talk about LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. And one issue that we never talk about is transgender persons, because we don't actually forget understanding. We don't even have the vocabulary, which is shameful on us. right? And we don't understand what it means to have male and female toilets and what that does psychologically for individuals. So we need to find the vocabulary. We need to understand how people are living and how people live in their own psychological dysfunction and mess so that we can become sympathetic, empathetic. All of these things are really, really important. And when we look across the pond and in other countries where we see the rise of right-wing populists and we see crazy lunatics who are leading countries, we sit there in hope, pray or not to pray, that this, that we don't ever have to deal with that.
I'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Aman Dasandi. It was a pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you. I could be sharing someone else's pillow. And my love for you is better than diamonds. To you, everything I bestow. And tomorrow I'll be dancing on my own. And I'll need a kiss from my head that's aching. And I'll be a hungry dog without a bone, hoping my place with you's not taken. Kiss me and tell me it's not broken. Kiss me and kiss me till I'm dead. See, I give you the stars from the blue evening sky.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy. It's 98.3 FM and it's Tuesday the 30th of January. That was Monday, To You I Bestow. And the next piece we're going to have is with Dr. Doug Cuby from the School of Law in UCC. He spoke to me about disaster law, an IRC-funded project that's running in the School of Law.
My name's Dr. Doug Cuby. I'm the Deputy Director of the Centre for Criminal Justice and Human Rights, the CCJHR, here in the School of Law in UCC.
Thanks, Doug. Can you tell me a little bit about your research interests, please?
Certainly. So maybe just to briefly explain, I worked in practice for more than 12 years before I returned into academia. So my professional experience was working in refugee protection and humanitarian assistance in countries such as Nepal, the Republic of Congo, Canada. So I come from a practical background working with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Red Cross movement. And so a lot of my research is around that nexus of the international legal frameworks that may be in place with the domestic implementation.
Okay.
So that, for example, when we're looking at humanitarian assistance, what are the role of non-governmental organisations? If we think about the Red Cross movement, TROCRA, Goal, Concern.
Very important work,
Hugely important work in very difficult circumstances a lot of the time, whether that's an armed conflict setting or whether it's during a disaster. So what's the role of governments to support individuals from other parts of the world who may want to come into their country to support them when they're dealing with humanitarian crises.
Okay, and then with your practical background, I suppose, as an academic now, you're very mindful of having a practical impact as well in the research that you do. Would that be fair to say?
Certainly. So the Irish Research Council provided funding for a project which was a collaboration between the Centre for Criminal Justice and Human Rights and the Irish Red Cross Society to try and bring together humanitarian practitioners in Ireland with academics working in an emerging field called disaster law.
Okay, so and that's why we're here today to discuss that. Maybe you can tell me what's the project title and what even is disaster law?
So the project itself is called Advancing International Networks for Understanding, Researching and Implementing International Disaster Laws. And I realise that's a bit of a mouthful. Really what the project is about is networking.
Okay.
It's about bringing together different actors who are involved in both the understanding, the research, the analysis of disasters with those who are doing the practical work on the ground.
Okay.
And people, when they think of disasters, so we're talking about earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, storms, those types
natural
of major
disasters,
events.
Natural disasters, really, yeah.
Well, we don't use the term natural disasters, okay. Although it's used in common parlance. There's a very strong argument here. There's no such thing as a natural disaster.
Okay.
We have natural hazards.
Okay.
So, for example, an earthquake is a natural hazard. But if that occurs where there's no people, there's no disaster per se. It's just a physical, geophysical event.
So it's the impact on individuals, human beings.
Exactly. Okay. So it's the interconnection between human vulnerability and human resilience.
Right.
So what are the weaknesses, the potential vulnerabilities that may exist for an individual because of, say, socioeconomic class or, you know, their status perhaps as a disabled person, elderly, children, women, there's a range of groups who may be potentially more vulnerable. And then what's the resilience factors?
Okay.
So, for example, are there disaster risk reduction measures in place to protect people? So at a basic level, you could think about earthquake resilient buildings.
Right.
So if you live in an earthquake prone area, we know that the majority of injuries and deaths that occur in earthquakes occur because of falling buildings.
Okay. So standard construction for the areas.
Exactly. So if you have buildings which are built to the correct code, then they hopefully will not collapse during an earthquake, and that will provide protection for people. So it's this interconnection between vulnerability and resilience, and then a natural hazard.
Very interesting.
That's a long way of explaining why the phrase natural disasters is generally moving out of parlance within the sector, just because there's always the human interaction, and that's what creates the disaster.
Has disaster law always been around, or is it a comparatively new development?
The answer to that question is both, actually. It's quite interesting if we look at, from a historical perspective, the Lisbon earthquake and tsunami of 1755. So, I mean, we're talking, you know, 300 years ago. It devastated Lisbon. At the time, Portugal was one of the major colonial powers, one of the major powers in the world, and their capital city was destroyed by a tsunami.
Yeah, I didn't know that. There you
no,
go.
No, we think here in Europe that wouldn't be something that would be a risk that we would face. But an earthquake under the sea can displace large bodies of water.
Yeah.
And so that event in 1755 had a major impact across Europe. So, for example, Voltaire's book Candide with Dr. Pangloss, they visit Lisbon in the aftermath of the earthquake.
Okay.
And so it found its way into the literature of the time, but it also found its way into legal thought and legal philosophy.
At that juncture.
At that juncture, yes. So, for example, the Swiss jurist, Emir de Vittel, talked about the need for nations to help other nations in times of distress.
Okay.
And that was actually the example he was using is now classified as the first instance of international humanitarian assistance.
Wow.
So the Lisbon earthquake was the first time that one government saw that another country had faced a particular hazard or disaster and said, we're going to provide you particular assistance.
Okay.
So that's 300 years ago.
Yeah.
However, from a legal perspective, obviously it wasn't developed until more recently. There was quite an interesting attempt to create an international convention in the 1930s under the League of Nations.
Okay.
So after the First World War, a lot of the actions that were taking place were trying to prevent conflict.
Okay.
But there was some also focus on the need to respond to things like the San Francisco earthquake from 1905.
Right.
There's also,
so it was kind of present in people's minds that these things can happen and we need to do something.
Yes. And actually it was the Italian context, the Italian both politicians, the Italian Red Cross and Italian academics have been at the forefront of this topic.
Okay.
And we see that today with the range of threats, whether we're talking about volcanoes, Naples is a very vulnerable city.
Yeah, I was thinking of Pompeii as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Going back into history, as well as earthquakes. And so there was in 1908, there was a major earthquake in Messina in northern Italy, which killed 20,000 people.
Okay.
And that really prompted the Italian government and the Italian Red Cross to push at the League of Nations level to create a convention, which was brought into being. But unfortunately, like many of the actions of the League of Nations, it wasn't as effective as it could have been. Exactly. So over, you know, the more recent time, say if we look at the last 30 years, there have been a range of moves to try and improve the efficiency and effectiveness of international assistance, humanitarian assistance. They've generally focused on non-legal methods. They've been looking at disaster management, looking at what we call soft law, so guidelines, minimum standards. How much water does someone need in a refugee camp setting per day?
Gosh, real basic
stuff. So there's a great, for example, project which has been running for more than 20 years called the Sphere Project, which is setting minimum standards for example, food, sanitation, you know, in terms of how do you set up
a camp.
Exactly. And the provision of water and sanitary facilities when you potentially have large numbers of people being displaced as a result of either conflict or a disaster. So there was a lot of focus on that. It was only really maybe in the last 15 years or so, maybe 20 years, that we've really had a realization that lawyers actually do have a role to play in this. When we think of disaster response or disaster preparation, you think of doctors, you think of engineers, you think of the sanitation experts who come in to provide water, the very practical life protecting fundamental needs. However, lawyers also play a role, because one of the things that we've seen at a operational level is if you don't have your customs regulations set up in place, there are often delays at ports of entry for goods that arrive.
Getting the crucials in the first place.
Exactly. And we saw that in Haiti with the Haiti earthquake in 2010. There was a blockage at the airport because actually the seaport was destroyed. So it was impossible to get goods in by sea, and the airport wasn't sufficient. But on top of that, there was a blockage for the goods coming in. So Haiti is a sovereign state.
Right, an administrative blockage.
Exactly. Okay. So Haiti is a sovereign state. And so if they're getting plane loads of stuff that's coming in, well, is that actually appropriate? Is it, does it fit with the climatic conditions, the religious or cultural norms of the country? I mean, you can think about it, for example, in say a Muslim country. If a country sends a shipload of beef or pork,
it's not
necessarily culturally sensitive. So there is a range of very practical issues, but you need to have the laws in place. Another really good example is around the visas for humanitarian workers. That, for example, if you think about say a doctor coming from a third country to, say, Indonesia after the 2004 tsunami. Is that doctor, like, qualified to practice in Indonesia? What's the liability around their actions? And what we've seen in many disaster contexts is that humanitarian workers end up going in on tourist visas because that's the easiest way to get into the country. People need to get in the hours, days after an event. However, they're maybe not actually allowed to work on a tourist visa. And the authorities might turn a blind eye to that because of the needs of a major event. But that's not a secure situation for the workers or for the country itself. So these are the types of things that the Red Cross has been pushing, particularly through what are called International Disaster Response Law, their IDRL guidelines, to try and get countries to think, well, what are the measures I need to put into my legal framework in advance of a disaster happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you try to sort out this issue of visas after the disaster has occurred, you've too many other things to
think
about.
That's right, it's not your top priority at that point.
Exactly. So this is where the law and ensuring that the laws are in place in advance of a disaster happening can help them facilitate response.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, Doug. And so in terms then of who is responsible for responding to a disaster in any given country, is it primarily that country of origin, say Haiti? Is the Haitian state the primary responder, or is there a moral obligation or a legal obligation on other countries under international law or elsewhere?
So under international law, the primary responsibility rests with the affected state itself. And that comes from sovereignty.
Okay.
Obviously, the state has its obligation towards citizens and persons living in its territory. Some of my work has looked at the human rights in disasters.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if someone has a right to food or a right to shelter in normal daily life, they also have that right in a disaster context. But obviously, the right to shelter may change if you suddenly have large areas of a city where houses have been destroyed.
Sure.
So once again, the Haiti earthquake is a good example of that. In Port-au-Prince, many of the houses were shanties and collapsed. So what does that mean for the right to housing? So the government already has that responsibility towards its citizen. The question is, how does the international community support the government?
Right.
So in many situations, the government will be quite happy to accept assistance.
Will they generally ask for assistance?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And this is actually, this feeds into a major project that the International Law Commission has been conducting since 2006. The International Law Commission is the UN body responsible for the codification and progressive development of international law. So, for example, the ILC, as it's called, writes draft articles, which may form the basis of a future convention. So a good example is the Law of the Sea. The Convention on the Law of the Sea started out as a project within the International Law Commission.
Okay.
And so the International Law Commission has been looking at the protection of persons in the event of disasters. And they've now developed a series of 23 articles looking at what are the responsibilities and obligations of states, the affected states and donor states in disaster context. So the primary responsibility rests with the affected state, but then obviously many states may want to provide support. The question is, what's the procedure in place for the affected state to make decisions as to whether they want to accept particular support or not? Because ultimately, it may well be that the affected state doesn't need as much support as you might think. Many states may well have mechanisms in place, and if they've been preparing the disaster risk reduction work in advance, there may be less need for international support. But out of solidarity, many states want to provide support. So, for example, I mean, Mongolia is not a rich country, but they provided $1 million dollars to America after New Orleans and the Hurricane Katrina as a
Very generous sign of
solidarity with another country that was going through a difficult period. Obviously, it wasn't the whole of the United States that was affected by Hurricane Katrina, and as a rich country with developed systems. However, Hurricane Katrina is also a really good example of how systems can fail.
Yes, and the domestic response there was slow, wasn't it?
Exactly, and it was unfortunately hampered by the plans that they had in place. So, for example, the evacuation plans for New Orleans were based on private car ownership. And so, obviously, it was the poorer people in socioeconomic poverty who faced the biggest impact, because they didn't necessarily have private cars and there weren't other means of transport to evacuate. And we see this all over the world, that obviously it's the poorest, the most vulnerable who are affected the worst.
Sure.
So even in the Hurricane Katrina situation, many countries provided support and assistance to America, even though in theory America is far rich enough to be able to support that themselves. So there's a moral obligation and also it can be a political diplomatic show of support. The question, though, which is interesting, is there a legal obligation? So, for example, does Ireland have a legal obligation to provide support to Nepal? And there's different views on that. Certainly, there would be very strong arguments to say yes, out of common solidarity with people all over the world, we should be providing humanitarian assistance. The UN says that we should, each country should spend around 0.7% of GNP on development and humanitarian assistance.
And we do earmark some money each year in the budget, don't we?
We do, exactly. However, in international law as it stands, there is no legal obligation for Ireland or any other country
to provide assistance. That's us acting on our own goodwill.
Exactly, exactly. And there may be diplomatic impacts if you don't provide assistance or if you don't offer support, maybe there'll be enough
down the road, you may not get it.
Exactly, you may not get it yourself at your time of need. But legally, these are some of the issues that are being teased out. A really big question that arises is, what happens if the government doesn't accept international assistance?
I was just about to ask that they should and they need it.
Exactly, and that was a real problem that we saw in Myanmar in 2008. So after Cyclone Nargis, you had a situation where this was still, the military junta were in place and they were just about to hold a referendum to change the constitution when Cyclone Nargis hit. Okay. And they stopped counting the number of dead at 200,000. So they just didn't, we don't even know how many people died in Cyclone Nargis. It was huge impact. And there was huge delays because the government didn't want international people coming in. They blacklisted UN agencies, they blacklisted Western states and so forth. And you had a situation where you had British and American warships moving towards the coast of Myanmar, arguing that they were going to provide assistance against the wishes of the government.
Sure, violate the sovereignty, I guess, there in the interests of the people.
Exactly, and that didn't come to pass rightly, because that would not have been a positive situation to end up in an armed conflict just to save people's life does not make sense. But it was also, it was an interesting approach to regionalism because India and China did provide assistance.
Okay.
However, it was a really good example of what happens when you maybe have situations where countries are not so willing to accept assistance.
Okay.
Maybe they have justifiable reasons. I mentioned earlier, if the assistance being provided is not culturally or religiously appropriate, the state should be allowed to say, no, we don't want that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if there's people in need in a particular country, does the world stand by and see them suffer?
It's a very tricky moral argument, actually.
We often see the same arguments around armed conflicts. I mean, look at the conflict in Syria. At what point should we already have intervened? Should we intervene? Humanitarian intervention itself, the use of force for humanitarian intervention is a very contentious area. Sure. That's not really one that I've been looking at.
Yeah.
The International Disaster Law Project, which the Irish Research Council funded, was about trying to bring together the practitioners who are dealing with these types of issues on the ground with academics who are maybe looking at these issues from a slightly more conceptual or theoretical perspective, so that we can see, are we talking the same language?
Sure. And if you're not, what can you do to improve
matters? So through the project, we had last year, we had two workshops, one in Dublin and one in Cork, where we brought together these different actors to discuss various issues around how we can develop a common research agenda for disaster law. How can we look to, as academics, research topics that will be of benefit to the practitioners on the ground, as well as of academic importance? And so what's arisen from the project is an application for a major EU funding project, which we're still waiting to hear the results
from. Good luck with that.
Exactly. But we're hoping that this project, if it's accepted, would be a five-year project which would set up a series of networking events across Europe to try and bring together, on a much broader scale rather than our Irish project, bring it to European level, to bring together practitioners and academics along with government representatives, civil defence, Red Cross, to come together to discuss how do we ensure that some of these roadblocks that may occur within national legal systems can be overcome in advance of a disaster occurring.
Yeah.
And how can we look at the regional and international mechanisms to ensure that those domestic responses are supported as effectively as possible?
You would think it's a very timely project and quite linked as well to mass migration and refugees in this time as well, Doug.
Just maybe on that point, so yeah. We're actually going to, the project ends at the end of March, and we're going to have a final event in Dublin in February, so in a few weeks' time, and we're looking at exactly that point. Yeah. We're going to be looking at disaster displacement. Mm-hmm. What happens when people are forced to leave their homes because of a disaster? Flooding is a very good example. If people are forced to leave, are they forced to leave for a short term or is it longer term? So one of the things that you can see with saltwater flooding, so if you have a storm surge that where the sea inundates the land, agricultural land may become too salty to grow effectively. Gosh. So even if the waters recede, it may be that actually people aren't able to go back to their homes, or the quality of their livelihoods are going to be severely impacted for many years to come. So when we talk about disaster displacement, we're not just talking about that immediate 24 hours when someone leaves their home because of an earthquake, but potentially this could be years.
Yes. So or permanent, I guess.
Permanently, exactly. So once again, that's a challenge for us to think, well, what legal frameworks can be in place to support people either who are displaced internally within the borders of their state or of their country where they're living, or what happens if you have cross-border displacement, someone who's actually goes into another country. Are they a refugee? Probably not, because the Refugee Convention sets out a fairly strict definition of what is would be classified as a refugee. So there's a range of areas which are quite of interest there, and climate change may well have impacts because we're seeing an increased severity and frequency or a variability in when natural hazards are occurring, and so it's harder to predict. And so therefore
who might be affected next.
Exactly, yes.
Doug, thank you so much for talking to me. If anyone would like to find out more about your International Disaster Laws Network or the project, where can they find out information?
We have a project website, which is part of the UCC family. So it's disasterlaw.ucc.ie.
Okay.
Or you can simply use a search engine.
Google it.
Exactly. Okay. For International Disaster Law UCC.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Doug.